Grief. That weird feeling that we all have heard of and we all felt at least once in our lifetime. But why is it so hard to talk about grief? Welcome to The Embarrassing Diary. Hello everyone to a chill, zen, relaxed episode. It's 9 o'clock in the night. I've put everybody to sleep, so I'm ready to shoot this episode. And today's episode, I have again the great pleasure to have Yarona Boaster in this podcast. She has been on the podcast on a previous episode where we talked about how to raise emotionally intelligent children. She's an incredible professional, coach, mentor, TEDx speaker, fertility advisor. I'm not going to even analyze how many things Yarona is. I'm going to put everything in the description. But I'm so glad that she's here today again because we are going to talk about something that she's really passionate about grief, about how our friends can help us relieve our grief, why is such a weird feeling, what can we do to help ourselves, why funeral rituals are so important for everybody, and of course, when do you know that you have overcome grief and you're healed from it or not? Are you ever healed from it? We're going to figure it out right away. Yarona Boaster is again on The Embarrassing Diary. Hi, Yarona. Welcome back.
Hi, how are you doing, Zoe?
You've spent a lot of your research on talking about grief. You even have a TED Talk on grief. So my first question would be, why grief is such a complicated and a weird feeling?
Because it goes against the grain of our survival instinct. Grief lines up so close. It's death. With grief is death. Grief is the way we process death. And it is antithetical to our survival mechanism. Our survival mechanism says, no, we have to survive at all costs. What I find very interesting is the reason for a lot of people's faith and belief systems comes from the understanding that we don't know what comes next. Granted, there are a lot of people out there who talk about, you know, having a moment, of facing death. And then so they talk about what their experience was like and coming back afterwards. But the reality is we still don't have any actual true scientifically proven evidence to point to something happening after your demise in the here and now. So it scares people.
It's scary. It is scary because we always feel like it will never happen to us for some reason. I don't know if you have the same feeling.
Well, when I was a girl, I was afraid of cemeteries. We would drive past the cemetery and I'd be like, hold my breath. Oh my goodness, so scary. Ghosts. And you know, when you're a kid, your imagination goes wild. And if you haven't had those conversations with your family and your parents, or they've sheltered you from death, it's also fear of the unknown. One of the reasons I wrote my co-authorship book specific to calling it The Investment Every Parent Needs is because I want people to start talking about when we die, not if we die. Meaning when you have a conversation with your child, well, if I die, it won't be for a long time, These conversations are not conducive to reality on the ground. You cannot make a promise to your child. You cannot make a promise to your loved one, your spouse, your partner, your friends. You cannot make a promise that you won't die for a long time. You can't make a promise that, I'll be old and gray and things like that, because there's no escaping death. And unfortunately, not a single one of us has the foreknowledge to figure out when our death is coming. If we did, we'd probably be a really, really rich person, because that would be a lot of foreknowledge of a lot of things. So the fact is, we have to stop making those promises to our children. We have to stop making those promises to our loved ones. And what my chapter specifically was, invest in the emotional side of this, where we have conversations that start to engage our children in gaining better awareness that there's an end to everything. And it starts when they're young. It starts with like the seasonal changes, where they start to understand, well, everything has a season. You know, there's a famous song to that, to every season, turn, right? And that starts the slow understanding of the loss and the finite nature of things. And then we get into more of the finite nature of things, where I can't always be here for you to tie your shoes. I'm not always going to be here for you to make sure you eat properly. I'm not always going to be here for you. Those are those little tiny conversations. And then they grow bigger and bigger. And even with your adult children, you should be having these conversations. But even with your partners, because unfortunately, so many people neither have those kind of emotional conversations nor an actual strategic plan in place. So in my chapter, there's also a lot around the strategic plan, which involves having not just a will, but having an advanced directive, which is a living will. A lot of people know about that, where you're talking about what happens in the event that you don't die, but you're in that in-between stage. Maybe you've gone into a coma. You've become brain dead, but your body is still functioning. So you might be on life support. What do you want to happen then? Do you want to be on life support forever, or do you want to have a time frame? Me personally, my advanced directive and my conversations with my husband and my sister, who are the closest to me, and my mother-in-law, know that I don't want to be on life support if I'm brain dead. I would actually prefer they not keep me on life support. If I have brain activity, I'm okay with 6 months to a year maximum. And that's really just the time that they might need to get all of the affairs in order. Then there's conversations around what to do if you have a life event that changes your capacity for living, meaning you have a stroke or you become paralyzed and you now need regular care. Are you going to a home? Are you going to be taken care of in-home? What finances do you have set up for all of these things? These are the in-between phases that we don't really talk about. When we get older, what is that care going to look like? What if we have dementia or Alzheimer's? What's that care going to look like? Then we need to set up durable power of attorney, which is a lot bigger than power of attorney. Durable power of attorney gives somebody the right to make medical decisions over your life and well-being. Power of attorney is only in the financial realm. Then we need to set up, you know what? We need to have a plan for our funeral or cremation or things of that nature. Because the best investment you can make is to ensure your family and loved ones don't have to make any decisions regarding these matters because you've already written out a plan.
Yeah.
And there's no fighting. Because one of the things I see families fight and break apart most over is death and money.
That's true.
Even if they're mad about the plan and they don't agree with the plan, they've got to go with the plan because that's your written plan.
But isn't it hard to talk about death to your child? Especially, I have a 2-year-old, for example, and even the idea of talking about me being gone scares me so much. So how can a parent, be a bit relieved or a bit more relaxed in order to address those conversations with their child?
Yeah. So there's a question I ask every parent. What is the one thing you want to know at the end of your life? And most parents, when they really think about the end of their life, wherever and whenever that may happen, the one thing they often want to know is that their children will be okay without them. And when we talk about being okay, we realize it's a lot more than financially set up, all that. It's actually the emotional okay. Will it be okay to carry on living after I'm gone? And so I say to every parent, if that's the case, if you want to know your child's truly going to be emotionally stable and secure after you're gone, you have to start everything you do with that end goal in mind. And that fear, you have to do that in spite of that fear. That fear is not going to go away until you actually address it. That fear is you clinging on to your little birdie in the nest rather than pushing them out of the nest. Right?
Yeah.
But when we get that understanding that, well, if I want to know that when I'm actually physically gone from this plane of existence, my child is stable enough to carry on their life, living their life wholly and healthfully without me, of course they're going to be in pain. Of course they're going to be hurt and saddened. But do you want them to be able to pick themselves up and keep going? Then you have to work with that fear, not against it. Yeah. You can't keep bounding them in security nets that you can't ensure will remain there after your demise. Guess what happens? If you've been the creator of those nets of security and bubble wrapping, those nets and bubble wraps, that's gone when you're gone. And then they fall.
Yeah.
And they've got no one to catch them because you were the creator of the catching. You're no longer there to catch them. So what you need to do is give them the tools they need to actually figure out how to craft those nets of security for themselves. And death is the ultimate pain. It's the ultimate painful driver because it takes away one's being of existence. When we have to face our mortality, it doesn't take away all the pain and all the fear, but it does help us find a way to face it at least. When it comes to facing death with our loved ones, there are a lot of conversations you can have around that in a healthy manner, okay? But there are ways to do this in a healthy manner. I have a lot of knowledge of this, and there are a lot of resources out there for having these conversations. Yeah.
I recently watched a theatrical show. He was a Greek / Albanian director, and it was all dedicated to funeral rituals that they do. And it was very interesting, actually. I think you will find it interesting. They talked about a young woman that she died really early. And it's a true tradition that they do in Albania that the woman that she's not married, they dress her like as a bride. They put a lot of gold, a lot of crazy stuff. And when I was watching it, I thought, wow, this is actually the way of the older generations to heal from grief. Because maybe it's something that was suppressed. What would the parents want of this girl? To see her get married and be happy and make a family. So how important are those rituals? That we have different rituals around the world. You have different in the United States. We have different here as well. How important are all of those rituals for healing from your grief or dealing with grief?
They're so vital. And I'm going to tell you something. When you don't allow your children to take part in some part of that process, you do them a disservice of taking away their opportunity to grieve in that way.
Yeah,
there is a comfort in that. For sure.
Because a lot of people, they don't take their children on funerals. They're like, no, they will be traumatized.
Yes.
So you should bring your child with you.
Yeah, I brought my son. My father-in-law just passed away a few months back in September of 2023. And I didn't really want my son to be a part of the wake because my husband's family isn't Jewish. And I had managed to never actually participate in a wake. I had done a lot of like participatory things in the aftermath with friends and family. But as a Jew, I escaped wakes for some reason. So it was very interesting that this was actually my first real close family relative of that where I'd be a part of. And I realized now that yes, there was a part of that was my discomfort with it. Oddly enough, I've been around dead bodies before, but this was like a wake was a bit different. So one of the things I said is I don't think my son should be a part of the wake, but I did want him to go to the funeral. So our plan was initially that he would come to the funeral home, but go into a different room with me. And I had a friend who was coming with her daughter to kind of keep him occupied. And then he would go with all of us to the burial, go to the burial ground so that he could actually be part of that part of it. However, there was an accidental mishap where the funeral director walked us all into the room where my father-in-law's casket was. And so my son saw and we stopped and I bent down to him and I said, Connor, you don't need to be in this room. We can go into another room. And he said, is Gapka sleeping? And I said, no, that's his body, but his spirit's no longer in there. His soul, everything that made him Gapka, and he's just not there anymore. And that's how I was able to say that to him. And I asked him, would you like to leave? And he said, no, I want to be here. I said, okay. And I made sure that we didn't tell him that he was sleeping, because one thing that I've seen people get wrong is telling young children that the person is sleeping. When they do that, you have to understand children know what sleep is because they experience it every single night. So then their brain goes to, oh my gosh, if I go to sleep, I'm never going to wake up again. They don't understand the more the bigger premise of this. So never tell them that they're sleeping. That's a very bad thing.
Yeah.
But you can explain the more esoteric concept of they're no longer in their body. So that's just their body. It's the vessel. You know, you can, there's a lot of varied words that we can use to explain that. But the spirit, the soul, the thing that made them animated and brought them to life, and the one that was able to talk to you and listen to you and play with you, that's no longer there. That essence has gone.
You're so right. Because as a kid, I remember they would take me to funerals, to my grandpa and my grandma. And it was actually, I remember it was, we were part of a community. They were the people who would mourn. I would be a bit scared of the mourners because they would scream sometimes. And I was like, why, like, you know. But then I understood in this silence, like, okay, she's in pain right now. So we need to respect that, like even as a kid. And it wasn't so terrible as I've had other more horrible experiences that don't include death as a child. And by that, I mean like car accidents and stuff like that. But speaking of that, what are the, maybe a very basic question, but what are the stages of grief?
I will touch on that, but I will say this
with
regard to children and the funeral process. There has to be, they have to be a part of it. I know in my TEDx talk, I specifically said there are villages there. You know, there's so many cultural changes and differences. There's a village in Kenya that the children actually bring the sticks to the home of the mourners for the funeral pyre, for the process. And they being involved in any way, shape or form, whether that's having your kid be a part of picking out the pictures that you want to go on, like, you know, if you're going to have like a collage, a memorial collage and things like that, they should be a part of it in some way or other. They shouldn't be completely shielded from it, like as if they're, where's Gaka? Oh, he's just not here right now. That's not okay. Oh, he went to a doctor. He'll be back. And then you just lie to them. That's not acceptable and appropriate. When my father-in-law died, I had to tell my son. And, you know, I picked him up from school that day. It all happened rather quickly. So in the morning after he had gone to school, it happened. And then, you know, he was in the hospital. We waited for his last bit. And then we started to process it. And when I picked him up, I had to tell him. I said, Connor, I have some very bad news. And he said, what? And I didn't try to comfort it or anything. I just said, Gaka died. And he gasped. He was really upset. He hugged me. And then, you know what he said? Well, it hurts and it's really sad, but maybe it's not such a bad thing because he and Grandma fought a lot. So now they won't be fighting anymore. And that is a child's resilient nature to find a way through it, because they're taking their cues from you. If you carry on, they won't be able to, meaning carry on by going on and you lose it and everything with them. They won't be able to process it in a healthy way. Now, it's not to say that you shouldn't carry on, because when it comes right down to it, if you're bawling and crying, they'll see that as a part of the process too. When my mother died, I almost fainted when we were at the graveside. And that's important for children to see. Now, my son didn't see it, but if he had seen something like that, that would have been okay too, because they'll get to experience, just like you did with those mourners, that there are a variety of ways to emotionally express yourself. So that's very important to note, and that children are excessively resilient to experiencing all the varying ways that we express that grief. Now, regarding the stages of grief, in the loss world, we understand that that's a very antiquated way of looking at it, meaning there is no beginning and end to grief. We now understand that the process of grief looks very different for everybody. We also understand that it never really goes away. I want to say something here, which I think is very important. and I don't remember who originally coined this term, but there's a saying that once you experience grief, the grief never goes away. It never shrinks. It becomes an inevitable and indelible part of who you are. But your life gets to grow around your grief. And so as time moves on, life grows bigger and bigger, more time and events and experiences and all of these things, just living your everyday life, taking one more breath takes you further from that moment in time. But what's very interesting about grief is it takes a step out of your linear time. It takes a step away from the chronology of the events of your living. And it lives in its own bubble. And what happens, I have coined a term of what I call like the grief rubber band. And I see that grief is more, the feeling of grief is more like a rubber band in the process of it. And that is, over time, the elasticity of it, when you first experience it, it's the strongest rubber band. It snaps in place and it constricts you and restricts everything you do. And every breath you take, you feel that restriction and that pain and that suffering when you initially experience it. But over time, the elasticity fades and fades. And then something may happen in your life where it snaps back into place and it feels just as fresh as the moment you first experienced it. Yet then, as you breathe, the elasticity grows again and loosens again, and it just fades over time. But again, the grief that's there, that experience, it stays with you. It lives in its own existence. And so that process, those feelings of anger and, you know, denial and acceptance and bargaining and all of these things, they're all over the place. There's no linear quality to them.
Do children feel, express it the same way as adults do? Like emotions of grief?
It depends on the child. As I said, they're much more resilient to it because they're kind of take their cues from you. So if you're falling apart, they're going to fall apart. If you're unable to process it and you kind of stonewall yourself and don't allow yourself to feel it, they'll do the very same. If you accept it in its beauty and pain and discomfort and all of those things, they'll feel it that way. My son is, we talk about my father-in-law. So what's interesting is every once in a while, like when we're watching something on TV, sometimes if we're not watching it for a long time, but it stays on, what will happen is we'll have a screensaver that comes up with pictures. And that picture, like one time we saw like a picture of my father-in-law, in fact, holding him. And he said, "Oh, Gapka." And I said, "Yeah, Gapka, how are you feeling, honey?" And he just talks about it. He's like, "I miss him." I said, "Yes, yeah, me too. And what do you miss about him?" And then we talk about that. And he's like, "Oh, I miss, he gave me cookies all the time." You know, even just those things. And everything is free to be felt. There's no, like, you shouldn't feel that way. There's no dismissing any feelings. All feelings are welcome. And when we give children the space to breathe and to understand that all feelings are welcome, even anger, I'm mad that Gapka's gone. I'm mad that he didn't get to see me do X, Y, Z, you know? That makes sense. Yeah. Just acknowledging those feelings, give space to those feelings, allows those feelings to breathe, and then all a part of the grief.
And that would be connected to my next question. I've had, unfortunately, my grandma passed away during COVID. And I wasn't allowed to go see her because of the restrictions and everything. And that really hurt me. Like, it took me way too long. And even now, I'm not 100% okay with it. Is there such a thing as uncomplicated grief that you don't express it and it comes back? Is there such a thing?
So there's a thing called complex grief. And oftentimes that happens when someone's been unable to process it for one reason or another, or there's been an excess of grief in a shortened period of time that they've had to do with this and this and this and this and this right on top of one another, where they've been smashed in the face with grief. And so one of the things that I could recommend for people who are dealing with say, a situation like you dealt with, is to have something to memorialize that person. If you weren't able to go to the funeral, you should schedule and set up a memorial. Have something on the memorial of her death, you know, on the date of her death. One of the things that Jews do is they have what's called an unveiling. So within the time frame of the person dying, Jews actually have quite an interesting process of grief. But within the year after their passing, usually on the memorial of the year, they unveil the headstone. So they don't uncover it. So if you ever go to a cemetery and you see a covering over a headstone, please don't remove it. That means that they haven't yet had the unveiling. I know that there was somebody who was doing, like, he was cleaning headstones. A lot of people go around and do this now. And, you know, he came upon that and he wondered what that was about. That was the reason for that. So never touch a cloth over a headstone, because they're going to have an unveiling. And that unveiling is the memorialization of that time. So they go, you go to the burial site and you unveil the headstone and you say certain prayers. And sometimes people speak about that person again. And then they have a little gathering maybe afterwards in the aftermath, you know, and they talk about that person. They tell funny stories, sad stories, all sorts of, you know, stories of that person. And that's a beautiful testimony to that. Jews also have a very different process by which we don't embalm the body. We don't do anything where there's a fancy casket. People who are religious, Jewish, you know, orthodoxy or even conservatives, sometimes even the Reform, will follow the same tradition, which is the seven-day period of mourning right after, in the aftermath of the burial. And what you do is you don't do anything other than clean the body, wrap the body in a special shroud, put it into a pine box, and the pine box will end up disintegrating underground. And then you bury the person as quickly as possible. And then you have the 7-day period of what we call Shiva, which is where people go and visit the people in mourning. And you follow, this is important, you follow the cues of the mourner. So if you walk in and they want to know what's going on in your life, you distract them, you give them that. If you walk in and they just want to sit in silence, you sit in silence. If you walk in and they want to chat and just converse about the everyday living and whatever, or they want to tell stories about the loved one, or they want to be angry, whatever it is, you take your cue from the mourner. And that allows them to really figure out how they want to focus their grief.
It's very interesting what you're saying, because I can already relate to it on a daily basis. Like when you're also grieving, you don't even have to be on the place where you bury your beloved one. And in 1 minute, you're like happy. You're like, not dancing, but like, you know, singing. And the next moment you smell the cookies that you made together with that person and you start crying like uncontrollably. Like this juxtaposition with those two intense feelings, it happens all the time, crying and laugh. That's how I express grief. And it's so intense and so energy draining. But at the same time, there's something liberating to it. Like when you cry, you're like, oh, just let it go. It's so good, really. I mean, it's so good in a way to let it go. That's what I mean.
I truly believe that we have, as humans, we're such complex creatures that we have the ability to feel two opposing emotions at the same time, and especially in those heightened stress-inducing moments. And there's nothing quite like grief to bring all of the emotions to the surface. I remember that when my mom was dying, and I was both of my parents' primary caregivers, so I took care of both of them until their death. And my sisters would come in and out. And when my mom was dying, we were sitting around my mother's bed, and at that point she had fallen into unconsciousness. We were sitting around, and we had been playing a lot of music and just talking with her, you know, because I firmly believe that people can hear you in that state of unconsciousness. And at one point we were looking for something else to play, and my sister's scrolling through her stuff, and I'm like, I don't know. And then my sister's like, well, how about Stairway to Heaven, which is a song. I don't know if you know that song.
I know.
And I'm like, oh, wait, I got one. And I'm like scrolling and I'm like, don't fear the Reaper. And then she's going back to hers. And we're like, the dark side. And like, we were just, it was, the funny thing is, we also knew if my mother was conscious, she would have been laughing her head off because that was my mother too. Like that was her humor. And I think what's so important is when you take your cues by what you know of the person who's dying and the person who has passed, you can really integrate yourself into that grief process in a very intimate way. And it's so beautiful.
Yeah.
See, there's a beauty in the finite nature of living. It really heightens your awareness of the fact that we have a limited time here. And that's beautiful. If we had an unknown number of time here, like meaning like if we had an infinite amount of time, I don't think we'd appreciate it nearly as much as the appreciation we can bring forward when we don't know. Not knowing is a beautiful thing.
Maybe when people hear about grief, they're like, oh my God, it's so grandiose and big and intense. It's not. It's humane. It's what you're saying. I like what you're saying. It is true because you can just sing like and laugh with songs, and the next minute you can also be very sad, and you can still keep going with your life. You still, even minutes before your beloved one goes away, you're still living your life. Your life still goes on, and that's a weird thing. Like you're like at the moment, how everything goes on. And I'm like stuck in this weird zone where I'm not okay.
Yeah. It's a very weird zone to be in.
Yeah.
And it's also possible to move forward with it.
Yeah. How can your friends help you when you're in a state of grief? How can they take care of you?
Make a space where they can just hear you out, hear how you're feeling, and not try to fix it for you.
Yeah.
One thing I hear so often is people saying, well, at least they're no longer in any pain, at least this and that, and their time suffering was short, or God has a purpose, or, you know, it'll be okay. One of the things I remember very vitally was when my niece passed away. I had rushed to the hospital. My sister had called me. She said things are bad and had been in the hospital all night. And I rushed there. And I remember getting to the receptionist's office, the receptionist area of the hospital, and walking up to her. And I was shaking. And I was like, and I'm asking for the information. And she looked at me and she gave me the information. Then she said, oh, honey, it'll be okay. And when I got upstairs and I rushed into the room, my sister put her hand out and she was like, don't come in here if you can't handle this. And I looked over and it was too late. My niece was already gone. And I remember as I embraced my sister, I was mad. I was so angry. I was shaking with anger. I actually had a moment where I wanted to go back downstairs and punch that woman in the face. How dare you tell me it'll be okay? You can't make that promise, and no one can make that promise to anyone. We can tell ourselves it'll be okay. That's all right. If I want to say to myself, you know what? I'll be okay. I'll get through this. I'll be all right. I'm okay. And then the next day we want to say, nope, I'm not okay. You know, that's okay if we tell that to ourselves. But for someone else to tell that to us means that they're belittling our experience. Never tell anyone it'll be okay. The best thing you can do is say, I don't know what to say, but I'm here for you. I don't know what you need to hear from me, but I want to be here for you. How can I best be here for you? Tell me how you want me to show up for you. I'm going to be here. I'm going to probably stick my foot in my mouth too. So if I say something you don't like, you get to tell me, that's not okay. I don't want you to say that. You get to tell me, how dare you say they're no longer in any pain? Why did they have to suffer in pain in the first place? You know, you get to tell me how you need me to show up. That's the best thing we can do for our loved ones.
A person I thought of immediately was my sister, because she would just be honest and she would say, okay, do you want us to watch something, or do you want me to leave you alone, or can I go to the shower? You know, like, she would pretend that things are still moving on. And I think that's also helpful, but not in a disrespectful way, but in a way that, yes, I'm here for you and everything is okay, but I know that you're not okay. Kind of like this kind of feeling that you can lean back on me. I'm around the house cleaning up, making some cookies, and I'm here. It's okay.
Like, I'm here for you. What you need, I got it. You know? Like,
yeah, exactly.
And don't offer. I would say try to stay away from offering platitudes. If you're not truly going to have the time to invest, don't offer something you can't. Because one thing someone needs in their grief is a true lifeline and not just words.
Yeah. And closing this very insightful conversation, when do you know that you have overcame grief, if you ever overcome it, like in a way?
Yeah, I mean, like I said, I think the grief rubber band will snap you back in moments. Mm-hmm. I think giving yourself the grace to understand that, when you fully accept mm-hmm. that you may never get past it, that's actually usually the moment that you do start to move past it. Mm-hmm. When you can really have those moments where you say to yourself, oh my gosh, my mom would have loved this. And then you only feel maybe a little twinge of pain at it and go like, yeah. And you have a bittersweet moment, you know. But like I said, I mean, my parents have been gone now. My father's been gone almost 13 years. And my mother's been gone for 9 years, actually. And there are moments where I even get frustrated, where I'm like, I wish you were just here so I could ask you your advice. Like, I just wish that. And I'll get a little angry. You're always going to feel those moments. But when it doesn't overtake you, when you can acknowledge it and then keep going, that's probably a good recognition that it hasn't knocked you out for the day. You know, when it does, when it no longer knocks you out for the day, but rather it's a thought that you can accept, acknowledge, and keep going with your day, that may be a moment where you can say, okay, I'm good.
Yeah. And that's a very also interesting what you're saying, because a lot of the emotions that manifest when you're grieving are the fact that the emotional impact that person had to you rather than the person. Yeah. So that is, can be a little bit tricky, because it can be a little bit selfish, because we keep on thinking on that person did a lot to me and made me feel this and this and that.
And the lessons we learned from them. I did a talk last August, and it's on YouTube. It's called Moving Forward with Loss. And I talk about how you can actually actively move forward with your life with your loss. You can carry that loss forward. One of the ways you can do that is keep reliving that person. If they were near and dear to you, or if they had a very significant impact on your life, you can ask yourself questions of like, how do I want to remember them? Oh, I want to remember those moments they made me laugh, or I want to remember those moments they made me cry, or I want to remember those moments they made me angry. You can really remember them in the everyday memories too, not just the big highlighted memories of like, your wedding or your this or your that, or but the little memories that you have, how they made cookies with you and the smell that brought up. Those sense memories are really important. I used to look at my hands. One time I was holding my son after he was born, and I saw my mom's hands in my hands. And it was so significant for me. It swept me away in that moment because she never got to meet him. So it was a beautiful, tangible moment for me to look at my hands and see my mom in them holding my son. You know, those moments are really important. And also the lessons we learned from them. You know, hey, my mom, she taught me to not be afraid to ask questions if I didn't know something. She taught me to question my knowledge and say, ooh, you don't know quite enough about this, Yorona. You better keep digging, you know? And those lessons are important. My father taught me when to shut up because he rarely could. And that's an important memory to have and a lesson to learn, you know?
Yeah.
And I think when we can learn those moments, those are really significant for us and they'll stay. They will keep those people alive in our hearts forever.
Yeah.
I'll tell you one last thing. My brother, it would have been his birthday last Tuesday. And on that day, last week, I was having a messaging with all of myself, his wife, his friends, our friends. And I said, okay, guys, what would Danny do today? And it was a slew of like, well, you know, he'd be eating an entire chicken and a whole bag full of fries, you know, and we were just joking back and forth and back and forth. And it was magnificent. And I promise you that a number of us cried, but we also enjoyed the cry, you know, because he didn't get to see his birthday. And it sucks. Yeah. It sucks. There's no one thing that is necessary to acknowledge your grief in is that there's no getting around the fact that it hurts that they're gone. But you can live with that hurt, not push against it, because acknowledging that pain also keeps their memory alive. When you don't even want to go there, when you don't even want to think about them, you also, unfortunately, take away the good memories. Those start to fade too. When the pain and the hurt is something you're unwilling to acknowledge, you also lose the good memories.
Yeah. That's why it's so important to honor them. That's why we're doing all of that. That's why we've been doing this episode, to honor all the memories of all the people that we loved and it's about them, but it's also about us to understand that, yes, they were important, to acknowledge. Yes, they're still important. They clearly have an impact to our life right now as we speak.
Yeah.
The lessons are here.
The lessons are here. There's a beautiful song, which I used a quote of at the end of my talk, not my TEDx, but my other one. And it's, the song is called Awake Your Soul, and it's by Mumford & Sons. And it says, in these bodies, we will live. In these bodies, we will die. Where you invest your love, you invest your life. And I think it's truly the testament of what death really should stand for all of us.
Yeah. Thank you so much, Yarona. I absolutely adore you. I honestly, I have so much love for you. Every time our conversations are so insightful, I think people also, from what I hear, they really enjoy listening to you, to your podcast. Before we close up, do you have any current projects? I know you want to talk about your book a little bit. Just a brief summary of what you're doing at the moment.
Wednesday morning Eastern time. It's 9:15 a.m. Eastern Standard Time. But if anybody's on LinkedIn, they can grab the webinar we're going to be doing, and they're more than welcome to RSVP and attend. It's called Conversations on Cracking the Rich Code, and it's the co-authorship book that I have launching right now with 21 authors all together. And it's a series of books by Jim Britt, who's the visionary author. And it's really awesome because it's ways that you can find to enrich your life, not just make your life rich, but rather enrich it. And it's a beautiful thing. So we're going to be doing that, where everybody gets a chance to hear from all the different authors in the book. And I also have a different co-authorship book that I had was out like about a month or two ago. And that was called The Gifts of Pain, which is a lovely book as well. People can find both of those books on my website, footprintscoaching.org. I am also launching a new parenting program. And this is geared towards parents when you don't have a whole lot of time, but you definitely want some information and knowledge. So
interesting.
Look at my website for that as well. And coming hopefully in the fall will be a new program for speakers. Because one of the things that I do is I do speaker coaching work, which is truthfully the art of communication. Because when we really learn how to communicate, we can communicate messages across all platforms, and we can communicate with our loved ones, the people in our lives, the people we build relationships with, whether that's your boss or your subordinate or your child or your parent or your partner. Communication is the key to helping us figure out how to live our best lives.
Amazing. Thank you so much, Yarona. Thank you for everything.
Thank you so much for having me, Zoe. I really appreciate being here.